I'm Sarah Kelleher, and this is Psych in the City, a podcast about sexuality, relationships, and health. One psychotherapist, me, gives you the sex and psych education you didn't get in social work school, or most likely anywhere.
Okay, so today I'm speaking with Marissa Carter. Thanks, Marissa, for coming on the podcast. I am really excited to have you.
I'm super excited to be here.
So we were taking sex educator courses via IC, and everyone that I've had on from IC, I just like to ask about have you been enjoying it? Like, what has been your experience?
Oh yeah, it's been great. I really like that you can do the pre-recorded stuff at your own pace, and then you just kind of sign up and reschedule for the live Zoom courses whenever you need it. It's super user-friendly and everybody's been super kind, and it's just been awesome.
So you are a pelvic floor therapist.
Yes.
I am really excited to, I've been wanting to have a pelvic floor therapist on the show because I am a sex therapist as well as a sex educator, and I've been getting more and more requests from people that have pelvic floor health concerns and issues. And I've just been learning so much. And a lot of the clients that I work with have just shared how fundamental having a pelvic floor therapist is in their journey. And I didn't know much about it prior to even, having a pelvic floor myself. It was just something that was never emphasized in my healthcare. And people should know. It's like a real, it's very real.
Yes, people should know. What I run into pretty regularly is people will come in to see me. They've been referred to pelvic floor therapy and they have no idea what they're coming in for, which is terrifying, because how often do you go to a healthcare professional with no idea what's going to happen in the office? It's scary. And so I feel like that's pretty common. And even just with healthcare, other healthcare professionals, they don't know that pelvic floor therapy is an option that exists. They don't know what we do. They think that we just teach people how to do Kegels, which would I really have gone to school for as long as I did just to teach people how to do a Kegel? But they just don't. There's not the awareness or the education that exists out there for how much pelvic floor function encompasses, not just in bodily functions like being able to control bowel and bladder continence, but the role that it plays in making sure that you have stability in the rest of your body when you're doing high level activities or even low level activities. Your pelvic floor does a lot, but the education about that is not available readily. People just don't know.
Yeah. And in preparing for the show, I realized that I'm asking a lot of maybe basic questions, because I want to say that the pelvic floor was never mentioned to me in any anatomy. It just was never brought up, really. I feel like it's a really under chatted about part of the body. And so tell me a little bit about, so what does it take? How do you become a pelvic floor therapist? What does that mean? How do you become a pelvic floor therapist?
So I went to PT school. That's a 3-year process. That's a postgrad doctoral level type of training. So you become a doctor of physical therapy. Mm. And then in addition to that, I took a bunch of continuing education courses to become a pelvic floor therapist. And there are different companies that you can take those things through. Herman and Wallace is one of the pioneers in pelvic floor physical therapy, education and occupational therapy now too. It used to just be pelvic floor PT. Occupational therapists can become pelvic floor therapists as well. But Herman and Wallace is a company that a lot of people will take coursework through, and the APTA has a series of courses that you can take as well to become a pelvic floor therapist. So I took a bunch of continuing education courses to become a pelvic floor therapist. And then as my last clinical rotation for physical therapy for PT school. Before I graduated, I did a rotation with a pelvic floor therapist where we worked with clients who experienced pelvic floor issues. And that was like the emphasis of that. So I got a lot of like one-on-one mentorship type of work. And then after I graduated, I got a job as a pelvic floor therapist and again, worked with some mentorship with another pelvic floor therapist to become what I do. For other people, like a lot of people will do additional mentorship where they work one-on-one with another pelvic floor therapist who has several years of experience in the field. And I think mentorship just in general is typically a good idea, regardless of how experienced you are, because you're always going to run into someone who has seen something different from what you have seen. And you will see different things too. So you both parties bring a lot to the table, but PT school plus a lot of extra training.
Did you know you wanted to work in pelvic floor when you became a physical therapist, or did it develop along the way of your schooling and education?
Yes. So when I was in school, I didn't know that pelvic floor therapy was an option until we had some people who were pelvic floor therapists that came and talked to our class and said, hey, this is what we do. These are the populations that we treat. This is the impact that it has on quality of life. And so at that point, I was like, yep, that's something that I want to do. Because before I became a physical therapist, I worked as a trainer in a gym. And a lot of like our female clients would say, like, I can't run, I can't ride a bike, I can't jump, I can't lift heavy weights because I have prolapse or incontinence and I will pee on myself or it will be really uncomfortable if I try to do that. And I would just get this feedback like, well, this is just what happens when you have babies and this is just something that you can expect. And I thought, how disempowering is that type of language to give someone? Like your result for having children is that you're just going to pee on yourself for the rest of your life and you should accept that as normal. Congratulations.
Yeah.
And so when I discovered that there was an option in helping people manage some of this and not have to accept like, well, this is it. Congratulate. Like, this is what you expect now. I don't know. Advocacy is really important for me. And so I feel like I get to do a lot of advocacy for people just as part of my job, but I felt like it's such an empowering field for people because who wants to accept that as just the consequence of having children? And also that's not true. You can have incontinence and never have kids, right? There are people who don't have children who also have pelvic floor issues. So it's not just birthing people. It's everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally agree. I mean, I feel like the only time that pelvic floor has been mentioned to me was in the context of giving birth or labor or that sort of thing, or even maybe with like menopause, like, oh, like peeing, like, you know, incontinence and that, like, as just like getting older, this is what happens mm-hmm. type of thing. And it was never, you know, brought up to me in a preventative or just even like part of healthcare mm-hmm. approach. So what is the pelvic floor? Like, let's go back to the basics. What is the pelvic floor?
So your pelvic floor is going to be a group of muscles and connected tissues like fascia and ligaments, nerves, blood vessels that settle just kind of in the base of your pelvis. And they do a lot of things. Like they support your pelvic organs, which for people with vaginas would be bowel and or like rectum, bladder, uterus, vagina. They're going to, for people with penises, that would be like bladder, rectum. Like it supports those structures. It gives you sphincter control so that you can pee and poop and pass gas when you want to, and ideally not do those things when you don't want to. It gives you stability. So your pelvic floor muscles are going to work together with your abdominal muscles. They work together with muscles in your hips and your back to provide stability to your trunk and pelvis when you're doing things like running and jumping, but also just like sitting and standing and rolling in bed and getting up and things like that. So they're important for stability, and they serve a sexual function too. So your pelvic floor muscles, one, they have to be able to like contract and relax. So that relaxation is important for, or that contraction is important for like controlling when you go to the bathroom, for example. But pelvic floor muscles have to relax for pee and poop to come out of your body, but also for things to go in your body, like for penetrative activities. And that could look like tampon insertion. That could look like receptive vaginal or anal intercourse. That could look like speculum insertion. And so pelvic floor muscles have to be able to relax for things like that to happen. But also, pelvic floor muscles are going to attach to part of the penis or the clitoris. And so they're important for things like being able to obtain and maintain an erection. The clitoris is an erectile tissue. So it's important for that as well, for orgasm, for ejaculation, for things like that. Pelvic floor muscles serve a lot. They help with like lymphatic drainage as well. Like they do a lot of jobs.
Does every person have a pelvic floor?
Yeah, if you got a pelvis, you have a pelvic floor, regardless of your gender, which is funny because I have had, I've heard male people say like, I don't have a pelvic floor. Like, yeah, if you have pelvis, you have pelvic floor.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think it goes back to the way that it is framed, in that it really is, in my experience, has only been discussed. I mean, also in Pilates and in like a physical, like a physical therapy capacity. I was an athlete, but I didn't struggle with, or not to my knowledge, had pelvic floor issues. And so, but I've only ever heard it in either a birthing or labor context, primarily related to women, mm-hmm. and, or in like a sports or athletic capacity, when there's like issues. What does a pelvic floor therapist do? Like, what could somebody expect from an initial appointment? Like, what does that look like?
Yeah. So typically, like I said, I will get a lot of people who have never heard of what I do before, or if they have heard of it, they've done like a Google search, and a lot of times something terrifying has popped up. Because Google's a terrifying place sometimes.
Yeah.
So usually in my first appointment with people, it looks like a really in-depth conversation. We talk a lot about, also I work in like a really private and like area that people typically, especially where, so I live in Arkansas, and a lot of times people are not used to talking about like what's happening in their pants, right? And so a lot of that first appointment is going to be like creating an environment that feels safe. And so we have a very in-depth conversation about the person's symptoms. When did they start? How long have they been going on? What makes it better? What makes it worse? We talk about bowel and bladder and sexual dysfunction. So typically when people are having issues with pelvic floor function, I'm not seeing them for just one specific thing. It might be like urinary incontinence, but also I'm having some issues with constipation or fecal incontinence too. Or leaking maybe like during intercourse, or not being able to tolerate intercourse. It's usually like a constellation of things that people are experiencing. So we talk about, okay, what are your bladder symptoms like? What are your bowel symptoms like? How often are you having bowel movements? Do you have to strain? Do you have to strain to empty your bladder? Do you have to use protective devices like pads or liners because you experience urinary incontinence? Are you using the right product for you? Mm-hmm. And then also, like, if you're having pain with intercourse, like, is it with initial penetration? Is it deeper penetration? Where do you feel the pain at? Are you able to achieve orgasm? Is it painful? Do you use a lubricant? Do you need vaginal or vulva our moisturizers if you're struggling with dryness? Like, so our first appointment usually looks like a really in-depth conversation about why they're referred to me. And then we will, so with pretty much everybody that I see, I assess their back and hip range of motion. I will check out their hip strength. I will check out their abdominal musculature. I will look at their breathing mechanics, because the way that, we can develop some interesting breathing patterns that can affect how the pelvic floor does its job. And then if we have time and the person consents to it, we may do a pelvic floor exam. So I assess the muscles of the pelvic floor either through a vaginal or rectal route. You have three layers of muscular support in your pelvic floor, which is like a lot. For reference, you have four layers of muscular support in your feet. So if we have three layers of support in our pelvic floor, like that tells you it's an important area, I feel like, right?
Wow.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, yeah. So we check out the different layers of the pelvic floor. And that's something that I only do with consent. And that's a conversation that we have as well. Like, patient is always allowed to say, hey, I'm not comfortable with that. I don't want to do that today. Can we stop? Can we pause? Can you leave the room? Like, patient has all of the power there. And that's how it should be. Consent is super important anytime in a medical field, right? In a medical profession, and just in general, consent is super important. And so that's a conversation that we have as well. Like, how do you feel about the idea of this? And I've had clients who are not cool with a pelvic floor exam. They don't want a vaginal or rectal exam. They're not okay with it. And that's fine too. I can treat and assess a lot of things from an external perspective. I've had people who I have like barely put my hands on just to teach them how to do things to themselves. And they go home and do the things and they still get better. There's a lot of ways to meet people where they're at and their needs. And some people are not okay with being touched. And I'm not going to put my hands on someone that's not okay with being touched. So we have a conversation. I do an exam if they're okay with it. And then we make a game plan from there.
So being touched, not a requirement.
No. Yeah. I've had people who, like I said, I have barely put my hands on. I have pelvis models. And so I will demonstrate the technique on the pelvis model if they're not okay with it. We'll talk through how they would do it themselves if it's like a massage technique. So pelvic floor muscles are muscles that can be massaged, just like muscles in your neck or your back or anywhere else. And so if I feel like they would benefit from some type of massage technique, but they don't want me to do it to them, or they don't want hands-on interaction like that, I will demonstrate how you do the technique on my pelvis models. And we will talk through the instructions, and then I will have them go home and try it. Or abdomen. I've shown people pictures of abdominal walls or hip muscles before, and we've talked about like the appropriate musculature that we're going to be targeting and how you would do massage to it and the amount of pressure that you would use and things like that. So hands-on is not a requirement. There are some situations where it can be really helpful to have that type of information, but it's going to be counterproductive to the patient's like progress and health if I like
force anyone
or something. Yeah, that's not what it's about. Like, that doesn't serve either of us if the person is like so intensely uncomfortable or activated that they can't absorb the information or relax into whatever it is that we're trying to do. That it doesn't serve us to force things if the patient's not okay with it. So
yeah. What are some of the most maybe common things that you see in your practice? It sounds like pain is something that people
deal with
and, incontinence, but is there more, like, are there a bunch of conditions that you regularly see?
So I see a lot of stress urinary incontinence. That's like when people cough, laugh, sneeze, jump, run, and have leakage.
Okay.
Or urge urinary incontinence. That's like when people get the urge to pee and then they are running to the bathroom and leaking on the way.
Okay.
I see constipation a lot. Constipation is super common in our country. Probably our diet lends itself to that, right? Fast food has typically not spectacular nutritional value and typically not great fiber content. And so I see a lot of people who are constipated, and I see a lot of people who are having pelvic pain, either as it relates to like pain with intercourse or just like pelvic pain in general. Or I see pregnant clients who are experiencing like pubic symphysis pain, pelvic girdle pain, hip pain, low back pain. I will say the majority of the people that I see also have low back pain as a co-occurring symptom. So pelvic floor dysfunction and low back pain are really commonly in, like, there's usually a pretty strong relationship there, because your low back and your pelvic floor and your abdominal and hip muscles, they're all going to work together. So if there's something that's gone awry in the system, well, it's going to affect the way all of these other structures are doing their job too. And so, and that's why I assess like back and hip mobility, because if pelvic floor is affected because our hip muscles aren't doing their job, then a lot of times your back is going to be involved in some way as well, or the opposite of that. If we've got back pain, hip muscles may be doing a job that's not necessarily theirs. Like they may take up slack for what we're lacking in lumbar strength or abdominal strength. And that's going to affect how things function too. So we really have to assess how all of it is working together. I see prolapse as well. Prolapse is really common too. That's where the pelvic organs can start to, basically they don't stay where we want them to stay. So they can start to bulge into the vaginal canal, or they can like bulge out of the rectum. So you can have a rectal prolapse where the rectum starts to bulge as well. And that's something that can affect people of any gender. Like a cystocele or a rectocele, where the bladder will start to bulge into the vaginal canal. I see that really commonly too. It's considered a birth injury in some situations as well, because people push really hard, or because of the nature of their birthing experience, they can develop prolapse. But then there are also people who never have babies who develop prolapse.
Like I was going to say, in those situations, what it could come from anything?
Yeah, it could come from anything. So with prolapse, again, it's like we're looking at a bunch of different factors that could contribute to that. So we're all made of different types of collagen. Like our connective tissue is all going to be different because of our genetics. And so some people are going to have a collagen connective tissue that makes them more susceptible to experiencing prolapse. But also we look at like, what has your job been for the last 10, 20, 30 years? Did you have a job where you lifted heavy things for a long period of time? And what did your lifting mechanics look like when you did that? Were you straining? Or people who have like chronic constipation. So if you've been straining to poop for your whole life, well, that lends itself to prolapse, because straining over time is going to weaken your pelvic floor muscles. And that makes prolapse more likely. Or chronic coughing, like chronic bronchitis or COPD or things like that, where people are coughing like a lot. That's a lot of strain on the pelvic floor over time. So really, yeah,
it makes sense when you say it out loud, but it's not the first thing that would come to my mind. Yeah. Can the opposite happen? Like, for example, whether this came from, I don't know, but I have heard and read, when I need to go to the bathroom, I will go immediately. Like I don't hold it. I've never held it. I'm not. And I actually sometimes feel that my muscles are weaker because I have never held or like that. And when I have to go to the bathroom, I have to go immediately. Is that related to pelvic floor? Like, is there a way to train?
Yes. That? Yeah. Yes. You can train that. And I will say that there are going to be some situations where it's like, you get the urge to poop, for example. So typically when I'm working with people where it's like, yeah, I have the urge to poop, usually we should go. Because when you delay having a bowel movement over time, so you have stretch receptors in your rectum. So they perceive like, oh, there's something in here. There's a stretching sensation and you should go to the bathroom. Well, when you ignore that sensation for long periods of time, they become less receptive, right? They become less sensitive to that stretch sensation, and that can actually lead to constipation. However, what we would consider a normal bowel frequency is going to be really big. So that could be as little as pooping as little as 3 times a week up to 3 times a day. Like there's a really big range for what we would call normal bowel frequency. And so from that standpoint, we're also looking at like, okay, what does your poop look like?
Yeah.
Like,
quality or like,
yes. Like, is it solid or is it like diarrhea or is it like rabbit pellets? Do you feel like you're emptying all of the way? Are you straining to make this happen? Is it painful? When we talk about bowel movements and as it relates to like constipation versus going too much, we have to consider like, well, okay, what are all of these other factors like? Because the range for normal bowel frequency is so big. Now, as it relates to urinary frequency, so how often you're peeing during the day, we don't always say like you got the urge, you should go, because your bladder, like the typical bladder, when it is full, will hold like 300 to like 500, 600 milliliters before it's like, hey, we're really full right now. We should go. Yes. But you will start getting signals that say like, hey, just so you know, there's something in the bladder right now. at like 150 milliliters of fluid. So not even like half full for some folks. The bladder's like, just so you know, there might be something in here. And so when you're constantly going, when you get that first signal, like, hey, there's something in here, that can actually lead to something that we would call increased urinary urgency and frequency, which is where it, like, we're peeing every 30 minutes to an hour or something like that. Mm-hmm. What we would call normal urinary frequency is going to be urinating up like 5 to 8 times in a 24-hour period. And so if you're experiencing really high urination where it's like, yeah, I have to pee every 30 minutes. I have to pee every hour. Every time I get that sensation, like, oh, I have to go and I can't hold it. That's a behavior that a lot of times we can retrain. It's a function of teaching your bladder, again, to be less sensitive. So it's like, oh yeah, I know that there's something in here at 150 milliliters, but we can hold more. We just peed 30 minutes ago. There's no way the bladder is full. It doesn't fill that quickly unless you're like guzzling fluids, and that's a different situation.
Right.
So we can probably wait, and there's a process of retraining, and physical pelvic floor therapists will work with people on retraining those behaviors.
Yeah. I'd like to talk about some of the common conditions that I know of, or well, one, if they are common first and foremost, and then discussing the differences in what people can experience and what they look like. I mean, again, as a sex therapist, I did not. And even with those sex education courses that, you know, we are doing, this was not in my therapeutic training at all, which in a way makes sense because sexuality was not covered in any capacity. So something more specific and in-depth, such as conditions that can relate to sexual function, clearly weren't present either. But I, with learning about them, many people don't know about them. And I've had a lot of people come to me and didn't know that what they were experiencing was abnormal, the pain that they were experiencing. And then they have years and years of experiences of it being extremely painful. And now there's these really strong associations with pain and sex and intercourse and pleasure and no pleasure. So like it gets really tied up together. And I think that's where the work of a talk therapist can come in. When you're building a treatment plan with somebody, maybe related to pelvic floor dysfunctions that can affect people sexually, which it sounds like a lot of them can and do, do you usually suggest talking to like other members of a care team, like a therapist? Like what is someone's, I'm curious, like what would be my role in that situation, in your opinion? Like, do you recommend that to clients? Tell me about that.
All the time. Yeah. I recommend working with some type of mental health counselor frequently, especially when we're dealing with pain conditions or someone who developed their symptoms after like a trauma, a relative died, they got divorced, there was a major life change. COVID, like they had a really like terrible COVID experience.
So real. And
I'm seeing a lot of those people now, and it's like, yeah, this wasn't a problem until I got COVID or someone died from COVID or things like that. Yeah. So I recommend that people, especially when we're looking at trauma or pain or just like significant life changes, work with a mental health counselor frequently. And I will make recommendations for people that I know in my community. Absolutely. There's a role for a therapist, a counselor there, because like, I can do a lot of things, but your job is not my job. And I don't know all of the things that, for example, a therapist might be able to address that I'm not addressing. So when I talk to, for example, if I have a patient who's coming to me with vaginismus, so vaginismus is when the pelvic floor muscles will involuntarily contract in response to penetration. And that could be like with a penis being inserted, but also like tampon insertion is painful. Pelvic exams are a nightmare. Like any type of penetrative.
Yeah, you avoid going to the gynecologist or can't.
Yes. Because it's excruciating. Yeah. And there are some issues within the gynecological field that are going to influence part of that too. But involuntary muscular spasm of the pelvic floor. And so when I have a client who is experiencing something like that, a lot of times we have a conversation about like, okay, what are your values around sexuality? Like, what are the religious influences in your life? What are the people in your life that like, what type of interactions have you had from that perspective? Because religious shame, especially in the part of the country that I live in, is pretty pervasive, right? A lot of people have been told, like, don't have sex until you get married, don't have sex until you get married. And then they get married and they're expected to be like super enthusiastic,
sexual and yes, great. Yeah.
Yes. And that doesn't happen well for a lot of people. And so we have a conversation about like, what were your perceptions? What were you raised with in regards to sexuality? Have you ever explored your body before? And do you have feelings of a shame, or like, is it a sin, or is it considered a sin for you to explore your body? Because for some people it is. And so in that situation, like just even using a tampon is going to feel triggering because like anything going in the vagina, they've been told a lot of times, like there's something sexual related to that. And so from that perspective, like we can talk about, and I will give them information and a lot of book resources about how there is nothing wrong or shameful or sexual or shameful about enjoying sexual contact or non-sexual contact, tampon insertion.
Yeah. In that area. Doesn't have to mean anything.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
But that is where working with mental health counselor is going to come in, because y'all do a lot more work with people in retraining and re-educating and teaching people how to explore themselves. And we have that conversation some, but y'all can go way more in depth with clients on things like that, or also just like processing trauma. Like I did not go to school for that.
Yeah.
That is something mental health counselors 100%, or teaching people better coping strategies. We go through some things like that, but I am confident that a mental health counselor, because I go to a mental health counselor, that they can help people reframe situations.
And it sounds like you give people tools related to like their physical bodies, mm-hmm. and a lot of like education surrounding sex education, body education, and where a mental health therapist could come in is talking about the maybe more emotional, cognitive, mm-hmm. mental processes surrounding all of this, but that it works really well in.
Yes, in tandem, for sure. I tell my therapist all the time, like, we should have an office together.
No, it's
I'll just send my patients down the hall to you.
Well, and I mean, I can't address the physical, you know, I don't have that knowledge. If someone's experiencing pain, you know, I've had people say like, oh yeah, with my pelvic floor physical therapist, we've like located the specific quadrant or where the pain is happening. And then now my work is kind of helping them cope, and also like just holding space for that experience of how difficult it is to be experiencing pain in your body. And in addition to other stuff, but yeah, I feel that we can't provide the same things. I can't physically do, I don't have that knowledge, number one, and I would never pretend to have it. And also that I can't provide that physical like education, bodily education in a way that you can.
Yeah.
Vaginismus is involuntary muscle spasms.
Mm-hmm.
And then vulvodynia, is that another area that
that's going to be like chronic pain that affects the vulvar tissue. So that could be like labial pain, clitoral pain. It could be pain like right at the vagina and the outside is called. So the transition between vulva, outside tissues, and vagina, inside tissues, is going to be the vestibule. So you can experience something called vestibulodynia as well. So that's going to be chronic pain that affects those outer structures, or that transition from outside to inside of the vagina. So like the internet definition is like, there's no clear association or cause of pain. And that is a lot of times like a really disempowering, definition, because like there's no pain, I just have pain. Sometimes
there's no reason.
Yeah, like that's, if you look it up, it's going to be like there's no clear cause of the pain or something like that. Which is super frustrating, because we like having
answers,
yes, and things like that. But that is something that I will see with people. Sometimes that's going to be related to having, so those three layers of pelvic floor musculature that we talked about, sometimes it's going to be related to having like a lot of tension in the outer layer of the pelvic floor. Sometimes it's a hypersensitivity to the area. Sometimes it's driven by hormones and medications can influence that. Sometimes it's nerve pain. And so if that's the case, then our approach can look like incorporating some massage. It might look like checking in with nervous system as well. So if people are super upregulated in their nervous system, body's going to be sent into like sympathetic activation, right? So we have fight, flight, freeze. And the way that that is going to, like, pelvic floor muscles are just like muscles in the rest of your body. So if we're super tense and ready for like action, escaping a bear in the rest of our body, like pelvic floor muscles are going to be really tense as well. And so part of that is looking like down regulating the nervous system. How can we make your body feel safer? Which again is probably an area where a therapist can come into, but we also look at like, are you breathing when you're doing things? Are you clenching your muscles constantly? Can we do an awareness activity where you start checking in with like, hey, what is my body doing right now? Can you even feel these parts of your body? Because I'll get people who have, they have no awareness of vulvar, vaginal, like pelvic floor muscles, regardless of gender, just no awareness of it. And so they're walking around clenched all the time. And we know that muscles are not meant to function that way. Yeah. So that looks like employing maybe some mindfulness techniques that we will talk through, doing like check-ins with their body where they literally put hands on different places and say like, okay, does this area feel tense? Can I soften it? No. What can we do to change that?
From a physical exam and an assessment, are you able to a lot of the time pinpoint or like determine if it's coming from nerve pain or if it's coming from a certain part of the pelvic floor? Like if that's something that you discover together with a client sometimes.
Yes. Yeah. So there are people who it's sometimes it, pain is really complicated, right?
Yeah.
So and so there are times when like, yeah, it seems like just the pelvic floor muscles in general are super tense. Like it's all of it, or they're holding their belly in constantly. And I see that a lot, especially with like my younger clients. And my theory is that there's just, I mean, like every message that people get from media about their bodies is that it's not enough. And so I see a lot of people, regardless of gender, who walk around with their bellies sucked in all the time, which is going to upregulate, like it's going to increase the tension in your pelvic floor, which can have an influence on all of those other functions.
Wow. So true. Yeah.
Yeah. But also, and that makes sense from like a pain response perspective as well. Like we want to guard, we want to protect. So it
yeah, if you're clenched, your body's probably like, okay, are we like in danger? Yeah. What's going on here? You know?
Yes. Yeah. And so a lot of times I am able to figure out like, okay, it seems like your pain is coming from this group of muscles here, either externally. It seems like and this is where that conversation comes in. Like a person's talking about, I'm having burning, numbness, tingling, and this one specific area is super sensitive. We might say like, okay, yeah, that seems like nerve pain. Let's address it this way and see what happens. Or I can assess the tone or the tension and muscular structure. So I put finger pressure or like broader hand pressure, depending on where we're working and if it's like a belly or something, or yeah, like if it's pelvic floor, finger pressure. And a patient says like, yeah, that feels exactly like the pain that I have every time I try to have sex. Okay. That's probably the area that we need to look at addressing. But again, it's like, typically a full body type of thing too. So it might be coming from here, but why is this muscle clenching? And is it because something else is not doing the job that we need it to?
Yeah.
Or is it hormone driven? Because hormones can have a huge impact on like literally everything in our body. And so if that's the case, then we say like, okay, this is a conversation that we need to consider having with like the gynecologist that you see or things like that. So I'm lucky in that the place that I work with a bunch of other gynecologists. And so if I see something that's like, yep, I feel like this is maybe not the thing that I can address best, I think you should talk to your gynecologist, or if you don't have one, I think you should consider making an appointment to see a gynecologist. And these are the ones that we have in this building, or urologist. I work in the same clinic as our urologist as well. So
I was going to say, do you work on a team?
Yeah, we all kind of work I work in the same space with the gynecologist, and like the urologist is down the hall. So we can say like, I think that you should consider having a conversation, and they are down the hall in this building. If you want to make an appointment with them, I think that would be wise. I can't make people do things. That's part of their like choices and things like that. But I can suggest, I think like And again, I work well in combination with urologists and gynecologists. They send me a lot of their referrals. And so we have this relationship where I can say, I think that you should consider having this conversation with them.
Yeah, no, that makes so much sense. And I think it is a total barrier sometimes because so much is related or could be related or just is helpful to have a team mm-hmm. component.
Yes.
But that also is really overwhelming for someone coming in with, you know, pain. And then sometimes in the past when I've suggested, like, you know, I think what I can do is limited a little bit, and it would be beneficial to see, you know, either a pelvic floor therapist or a gynecologist, or kind of get a, what are we working with here? You know? But there's a lot of barriers that make that not possible for people, which we have to work within. But it is like pain. I like what you said about like pain's really complicated because it is, it's not just one thing, I imagine.
Yeah, totally. Well, and with things like vulvodynia, for example, like I see vaginismus quite a bit. I don't see vulvodynia quite as often. And so there is like a special clinic that addresses issues related specifically to things like that, but it's like an hour from. So there are specialties even within like the gynecological field. And so there's a clinic like an hour away from where I treat that has a vulvar clinic where they see people specifically for vulvar related issues like twice a month. And so with that, there comes like a lot of privilege in being like, can I take off work on one of these two specific days and then
drive an hour?
The ability to drive an hour, like, do I have the resources to be able to do that? And some people don't, which is frustrating. And so from that standpoint, we do the best that we can with what we have.
Yeah. Is there a regional component? Like, do you see a bunch of, is that just what your clinic specializes in? So you see more people come to you for those reasons, like whereas a vulvar clinic, they're treating or helping manage different conditions. And so it just happens that that's how it's separated.
Yeah. So like within gynecology, like there's a bunch of different specialties that people can take. So there are some people that specialize like in vulvar disorders and things like that. There's a gynecologist. She has a really great platform on Instagram. Her name is Dr. Jill Krapf, Krapf.
Mm.
I can't remember where she's located in like northeastern part of our country, but that's what she specializes in. So issues like vulvodynia, issues like lichen sclerosis, things like that, vulvar disorders. I work in a small town in like central Arkansas. And so our gynecologists are great, but they see like pretty basic gynecological issues. And for something more specific, a lot of times we'll refer out to a larger city, which is an hour away from me, where there's like urogynecology is an option. That's a specialty within gynecology, or like the people that see those vulvar disorders.
Meaning now, like more related to urinary. Is that
more related to like prolapse or so like basic gynecology is going to look like maybe like some levels of prolapse. They can do some surgeries to address pelvic organ prolapse or urinary incontinence. And sometimes the urologist will do those surgeries. So a urogynecologist is going to look more specifically at like, this person has prolapse and they want a pessary, do you know what a pessary is?
No.
Okay. So a pessary is like a medical grade silicone or a plastic device that comes in a bunch of different shapes. A lot of times they come in rings, they look like a disc, sometimes there's a cube, they come in a bunch of different shapes. They've existed for like ever. And the idea is that if a person is experiencing prolapse where their pelvic organs are dropping into the vaginal canal, you can insert a pessary and it functions kind of like a splint would for your ankle. It supports. So it helps with relocating or supporting those organs that are prolapsing.
Got it.
Yes, they're super cool.
Someone would wear that temporarily or longer term.
Or long term.
Got it.
It depends on what their desires are. So some people aren't great candidates for surgery. If you're not a great candidate for surgery, pelvic floor therapy and prolapse is going to be a good option for you. Or some people just don't want to have surgery.
Especially
like younger folks, they're not done having children, or they just don't want to have a surgery. If they don't have to have a surgery. They will choose to manage with pessaries, or it could depend on the situation. So I know people who like don't have issues with prolapse most of the time, but if they're going to go out and power lift, they're probably going to wear their pessary. So it depends on like the demand of the thing that you're doing and when you notice your symptoms and if it's with certain things or like older folks who have prolapse and they don't want to have a surgery. Okay, you get a pessary. And some of that's going to depend on like, are you still sexually active or no? Because they have pessaries that they insert and you leave it in for like 2 to 3 months. And then you go to the gynecologist, they take it out, they clean it, they check the tissues and stick it back in. Pessaries are super cool.
It's like, even hearing you say, I've never heard that word in my life. And it's, I just wish it was more norm, these devices and these options more normal, or just there people, more people knew about them, because I don't think they do.
Yeah.
You know, because it's one of those things where it's like, if you don't have to care, you don't, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like, if somebody doesn't have a certain lifestyle, like if they don't power lift, or if someone doesn't have a certain lifestyle, or if somebody doesn't struggle with pain or discomfort in this way, I think that that must be really limiting for people and really hard if you are someone that is experiencing this and is really isolated in that, that you don't really know what to do, or, yeah, or you don't know about these things. And like, that's an incredible option for people. And like, wow, that's so great. So do you have a specialty, I mean, like your pelvic floor in general? And mm-hmm. then, so, but then if someone is coming in with something that specifically maybe is not your specialty area, you will refer out.
Oh yeah. If there's something I feel like I don't know how to treat, I will look for other resources for people. Pelvic floor. So there are, I'm sure, people within the pelvic floor physical therapy field who pick like really specific things to specialize in. I'm a one person team where I work. So if it gets sent to me, then I treat it. And if I feel like I don't have the tools to address something like that well, then I will refer out. Or if I work with a person and it's like, you know what, I feel like we're not like making the progress that we should be, here is another person or resource who I think might be better suited for working with you, that you can discuss some of this with, or see if they fit better. So there's that as well.
Yeah. What about endometriosis? Is that something that you work in?
Yeah. Endometriosis is interesting. Like, it's super common and it's hard because, so like 1 in 10 women worldwide, 1 in 10 people with vaginas are going to have endometriosis. That's like, it is super common, but it takes an average.
It does if it's like so rare.
Yes. And it takes like on average 4 to 7 years to get a diagnosis of endometriosis. Like, it's hard to diagnose. It can only be diagnosed with like a laparoscopic procedure. They don't have many. So the gold standard treatment for endometriosis is an excision surgery. That's where they go in and they cut out the endometriotic lesions. But there are not a ton of endometriosis excision specialists in the United States, or just like in general. Like, it's like a really specialized and specific part of that field. A lot of doctors will do an ablation surgery, which is an option for treatment. That's where they go in and they burn out the endometriosis lesions. But if they don't get the entire lesion, it will come back.
It'll grow back.
Yeah, it can grow back. And even with, so a lot of times they will treat endometriosis with like a hysterectomy. The endometriosis is not coming from, like, it's endometrial like tissue. So it's not like coming from the uterus. And so you can remove a person's uterus and they can still have endometriosis and the symptoms and things like that. Because they've taken out the uterus. Okay. So if there was endometriosis on the uterus or around the uterus, then you've removed that part. But endometriosis lesions can be found on like the diaphragm and bowel and all of those other tissues in your abdomen. And so if you're not addressing those areas too, you're still going to have the symptoms. Endometriosis is really hard. It's hard for, so what I do with people, a lot of times when I see people who have endometriosis, we're also looking at hypertonic pelvic floor muscles. So pelvic floor muscles are super tense.
Right, in their natural state.
Yes. Yeah. They just hang out with really tight pelvic floor muscles, which can give people like abdominal pain and back pain, and sex can be painful and it can be hard to pee and poop and all of those things because muscles.
So hypertonic means tight.
Very tense. Yes.
Tense. Okay.
In contrast, hypotonic would be like low tone, not a lot of tensile like movement, right? But that would be something that I see more commonly in people who are like postmenopausal. They don't have estrogen support anymore. And so estrogen is kind of what helps to keep the tissue supple. When we're not making it anymore, you can get lower tone. And that a lot of times will look like urinary incontinence and things like that. But with people with endometriosis, a lot of times I see really tense pelvic floor muscles. And so we look at, okay, can we teach these muscles to relax? And that could be in response to like just being in pain for a significant amount of time monthly, right? Because usually people with a lot of times people with endometriosis are going to have really significant period symptoms or premenstrual symptoms, right? And so
like heavy flows,
heavy bleeding, super intense, debilitating cramping. So in the week leading up to like the actual start of their period, really debilitating symptoms or headaches or like a lot of, we call that dysmenorrhea when people have really intense or just intense, just notable like pain with their periods, right?
Yeah.
And so from that standpoint, we look at, okay, what can we do to teach the pelvic floor muscles? Like, hey, we maybe don't have to be super tense all the time, but also like what's going on in their belly? Is it super tense because they've been guarding, right? Because cramps, things hurt, we take the fetal position and we stay there, which makes sense. Like your body wants to feel safe, but having bellies tense all the time is not going to serve us quite as well. But that might also look like doing some, I can do some fascial work to affect. So we have like our muscles, and then wrapped around all of our muscles, we have this stuff that's called fascia. It's a connective tissue. It keeps us packaged nicely so that we're not just like a blob of stuff. And sometimes you could form adhesions in fascia or in scar tissue. And so physical therapists just in general are trained to like address scars. And so that's something that, I mean, that's part of our training as physical therapists to address scars. And so that might look like abdominal scarring after a laparoscopic procedure or C-section even. Mm-hmm. But pelvic floor therapists can take some extra classes and learn how to address the fascial structures that can be affected by endometriosis in the abdomen or pelvic floor. So,
yeah. Wow. So how you said there was a little bit of a barrier with being diagnosed with endometriosis. Is that mm-hmm. because it requires an internal exam?
Yes, it's because it requires like a surgical procedure to diagnosis. They do typically like an exploratory laparoscopic procedure. And if they're going to do that, then typically a lot of times the game plan is, well, we're going to go ahead and do an ablation surgery and remove the lesions that we find. Typically so it's like a diagnosis of exclusion, right? They say, okay, it's, we think it might be this. We're not 100% sure. The gold standard for diagnosing it is going to be surgery. Typically people are not just like jumping straight into surgery because it's a surgery and there are risks that come with that. So they say, okay, let's try management with hormonal birth control. And then let's try management with they have some medications now that are specifically for people with, they think that they have endometriosis. So Orilissa is one of them. Let's try management with maybe like physical therapy and see how we do. Let's try management with these other things. And then if we're still struggling or you're still having these symptoms, we might talk about doing a surgery if the patient is appropriate for surgery or things like that. It's a diagnosis of exclusion most of the time where it's like, okay, we think it's probably not these other things. They'll do an ultrasound. So they may do like a vaginal ultrasound, an abdominal ultrasound, transvaginal ultrasound. Where they look to see if they can find any other thing that might be causing some of the pain, like fibroids or cysts or things like that. Endometriosis is not something that you're going to see on like an ultrasound generally. So
yeah, it is one of maybe the treatment goals for a lot of people, reducing discomfort or mm-hmm. reducing pain. Yeah. And do you see, I imagine it's so different person to person, but do you see a lot of success in that? Something that's a question that sometimes I get asked, which is unanswerable am I gonna ever, is this ever gonna shift for me? Is this ever gonna am I ever going to have pain-free penetration or insertion? Am I ever like, what is, I don't know. Like, how do you cope with that yourself and just talk about that with people?
Yeah. So I would say it depends on the person. It depends on the situation. If we're talking specifically, do you mean like specifically with endometriosis or just like pelvic pain in general, or
like pelvic pain in general, and I know that there's so many specific conditions that fall within that, but yeah, like if you're experiencing pain, is one of the goals maybe not to eliminate pain entirely, but like move it down on the scale? Like, is that, what does that look like?
Yes. Yeah. So I would say it depends obviously on the person and the case and the situation and things like that. So I write goals. Like, I have to do that for insurance purposes, but also like we need a direction to track in. So I write goals for people. And so one of my goals will be a patient to report a decreased pain with intercourse with pain rated at like 0 out of 10, 90% of the time. So the majority of the time, can we have pain-free sex? And I do have a lot of people that get to the point. Not everyone does, because everybody is different. But I do have a lot of people who get to that point. Part of it is also looking at like, okay, what is the cause of their pelvic pain? So is it because like they are afraid of leaking on themselves? So if I'm afraid of leaking, peeing on myself while I'm having sex, like that person is going to have tension in their muscles all the time, right? And so part of that's going to be, okay, can we address what's causing the urinary incontinence? Is it because our muscles don't have the support that they need to, or because they're never relaxing? Can we get that resolved? And if a person feels secure, like, hey, I'm not going to pee on my partner while we're having sex, a lot of times we can get to the point where we're having pain-free sex. If it's related to vaginismus, that might look like incorporating vaginal dilators. And so have you heard of dilators?
Yeah. Can you explain what they are though? But I have heard.
Yes. So dilators are going to be medical devices that are typically like phallus shaped. They start out in really small sizes and they get progressively larger. And so in therapy, our goal is typically, so we pick a goal size. My patients get to have a fun conversation with their partner where they measure the thing that they're trying to penetrate with, if it's a penis or a sex toy or whatever. We pick a goal and then we try to work up to that goal. For some people, it's just, I want to be able to insert a menstrual disc or a tampon and it not be painful. Like, the goal needs to serve the person.
Right. So really individualized.
Yes. And so if it's, I want to be able to have sex with my partner who has a penis, we say, okay, what size do we need to be working towards? We introduce dilators and treatment. And then that's something that I give people to work with for homework, because like, you are going to be doing this at home. So we look at progressively incorporating larger sizes with really minimal or no pain, because dilators don't. So a lot of times people will feel like dilators are meant to stretch the vagina. And that's not really how dilators work, unless we're looking at someone who has had like a gender affirmation surgery and they have a neo vagina, in which case dilators do serve more of a function from that perspective. But from a person who is assigned female at birth and has not had any like vaginal surgeries, vaginas stretch. Like, a whole person can come out of a vagina. They are capable of expanding. And so what we do is we use dilators to downregulate, to moderate that nervous system response that says, nope, I'm going to create tension in response to penetration. So it becomes about teaching your brain, like, hey, we can insert things and muscles don't have to create a protect response.
Yeah, I have heard of dilators and that approach. But I really like what you said about, it's not all about stretching, which I think is a common misconception of, you know, the dilators inserted and then it, you know, you're teaching the muscles to stretch, but it sounds like vaginal walls, they're doing that. And that's something that maybe you would teach someone in an office and then give them tools to go home with and practice with themselves or with their partners or whatever that looks like.
Absolutely.
What are some other like devices or tools? Like, are there creams?
Yeah. So there are a bunch of different options out there. In terms of medication, some people will use a vaginal Valium. So it's like a suppository that they insert in the vagina that can help the muscles relax. Sometimes people will do that like before they come to therapy or before they attempt intercourse with their partner. They make like lidocaine creams that people can use. There's a lubricant out there that I think is called Desert Harvest that has lidocaine in it, can help with pain relief. Some people respond well to lidocaine. Some people do not. It elicits like a really terrible burning sensation for some folks. So that's a troubleshooting type of thing there. Yeah, there are different options from that perspective. There are different lubricant options out there that are available as well, but also other tools that can be used to help mitigate some of that pain. And so what it becomes about is saying like, okay, are these tools that we can use in the meantime until we get to the point where we can have sex and we don't have to incorporate all these tools? Or are these things that we're going to use as like a precursor? So for some of my clients, it might look like doing some stretches to the pelvic floor before you try to have sex, or using them as needed. So like things are going well, then we have a significant shift in life or whatever. We start developing a lot more tension in our body or whatever. We may have to go back and use some of our tools again. So they make these things that are called TheraWands. They are like a funky S-shaped kind of device, ergonomically designed for you so that you can insert it either in the vagina or in the rectum to massage and mobilize pelvic floor muscles. Mm. That can be used for any gender. The dilators, they actually have rectal dilators as well that will use for people who've had like an anorectal cancer or okay. something like that, and they develop scar tissue in the anus, or they develop some coordination issues with bowel movements and suddenly pelvic floor muscles aren't relaxing or stretching well enough for poop to come out of the body and bowel movements get painful.
Mm.
So there are anal dilators for things like that. There's a company called the O-Nut. They are the bomb. They have silicone rings that are super stretchy. They slide over the person's penis and they create a barrier. So if a person is experiencing pain with deeper penetration, you can slide as many rings as you need to limit depth so that you don't get to that point. And then person can pursue the positions that they want without pain with deeper penetration. There's a lot of devices out there. They make some for prolapse too. Like there's all kinds of stuff that super smart people who have run into issues with this stuff a lot of time have created to make life more accessible for people who experience pelvic pain or prolapse or like whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's so awesome.
Yeah. It's super cool.
There are some barriers with receiving pelvic floor therapy or treatment. And are there, if that's not in the cards for somebody, whether, well, first, is pelvic floor therapy covered by insurances?
Yeah, it is. It's physical therapy, just like, I mean, it's just a really specific kind of therapy, but it's physical therapy. So if you have physical therapy benefits for your insurance, then your insurance should cover pelvic floor physical therapy.
If somebody, that's not an option for them mm-hmm. to seek out, whether now or ever, like a physical therapist, pelvic floor specialty therapist. Is there things that they can do if that's not in the cards for them that mm-hmm. could potentially help?
Yes. So there are some free resources that I really like that are available. Intimate Rose is a company that was created by a pelvic floor physical therapist. She sells those devices that we've been talking about. So she sells dilators. She sells TheraWands and lubricants and moisturizers and things like that for a pelvic floor. And what is great about that site, they're medical devices. So if you have a health savings account, you can use a health savings account to purchase these things if that's a thing that you have. But also if you don't have insurance, but you want to invest in these devices because you think they would be helpful, they have a ton of videos on their page about how to use them on your own. If you don't have access to a pelvic floor therapist, they can teach you through those videos, like how to use the device that you're trying to incorporate to manage pain or to incorporate dilators or things like that. Like they're super educational and helpful. There's another person. She has a YouTube page. It's called Dr. Bree's Vibrant Pelvic Health. Mm. On YouTube, she has a ton of videos, free resources. She's super helpful. She's just like a very encouraging person in general. But her page is really helpful and she's got free videos and stuff like that. There's a content creator on Instagram that I love. Her handle is at Vagina Rehab Doctor. Mm. She's awesome. And she has a great webpage with blog and all kinds of stuff. She's spectacular. There's a lot of great stuff that you can find on the internet that's free. That would be a good option too. Oh, Dr. Susie Gronsky is a pelvic floor therapist, and she operates out of North Carolina, I think, but she specializes in like men's pelvic health disorders.
Oh,
and
cool.
So yeah, she's the bomb. And you can schedule, like, maybe you can't go to like a full whatever pelvic floor therapy, but she schedules consultations with people. So you might be able to afford something like that with her. She also has a blog, and she also has a book. I think it's called like Pelvic Pain, the Ultimate Cock Block is, I think, the name for
it. Like, yeah.
It's great. But she also has like a podcast where she talks with people about pelvic floor disorders and stuff like that. She's a great resource too. There's a lot of really good, like, free stuff out there. If you don't have the ability to go to like pelvic floor therapy, and that like, there's a lot of privilege that comes with being able to go to pelvic floor therapy. And so acknowledging, like, not being able to take off work, not having childcare resources, so what's great is with COVID, a lot of people were able to shift to like doing pelvic health consultations online. So maybe you can't go into a clinic to see a pelvic floor therapist, but you might be able to find someone in your area that practices online too. And there's a database through Herman and Wallace. And then there's another woman. I think her name is Tracy Scher. And I think her website is like pelvicrehab.com. But there's a database where you can search for pelvic floor therapists in your area if that's something that you need. Let's see. There's just a lot of free content. Part of it is also like expanding. So it's the education component and expanding kind of what if like you're having pain-free sex. Okay. Expanding like, well, what does sex mean to you? Is it like penetrative interactions only? And if you expand your definition to include like mutual masturbation or oral interactions or just manual or I call it taking a penetration vacation, where we just like put it to the side for a second, exploring like, can I create partner intimacy in ways that don't involve penetrative activity? And is that like, can I still find fulfillment from that? Right?
Totally.
Oh, and there's a ton of support groups like on Facebook. So I'm in a few of those groups. For prolapse, there's one that's called like pelvic organ prolapse, pessaries, and support. There is the Pelvic Pain Support Network for people who have pelvic pain. There is a group specifically for pelvic congestion syndrome there, which is not something that we've talked about, but it is the thing that affects people who have pelvic floors. And Nancy's Nook for endometriosis education is a spectacular resource for people who have endometriosis. They have pages and pages and pages of like resources for people. Yeah, it's on Facebook. There's a lot of resource group. Nancy's Nook is so extensive in terms of like the resources they have for people with endometriosis. But also it's nice just because like a lot of times pelvic floor disorders feel very isolating.
100%. Yes.
People don't talk about what's going on in that area either, because like, we just don't talk about like what's happening in our pants.
Or like you take a risk and share someone, and then they don't have that experience. And then you're like, oh, okay. And then you it's often, I think I have found that like sex educators, health doctors, PTs, like people are putting out so much information because they are aware of some of the barriers that come, and like also try to acknowledge the real negative experiences that people have sometimes with the medical industry and the experiences there, and like are trying to make it more the information, just putting it out there. And there are so many, thanks so much for sharing all those resources. I mean, there is so much, especially on YouTube. It's like amazing what people are putting on there. It's like, thank you so much. You know, anything else, final encouraging words, anything else that we missed that you wanted to talk about?
I think I mean, we've covered
a lot. Thank you so much, Lizzie. Like, shared so much.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What I would say is, like, anytime you walk into an office and someone invalidates the experience that you're having in your life, like in a medical setting, you are totally allowed to get a second opinion. And a lot of people don't realize that. So you are allowed to say, and definitely when it comes to pelvic floor disorders, like, it's important to advocate for yourself, because like I said, a lot of people don't know, providers don't know that pelvic floor therapy is an option or the extent of the things that we cover. And so advocating for yourself and saying, like, hey, I think this would be a good idea. It's an opportunity for a patient to educate their doctor about the thing that they tried and it helped. And so that comes with the patient feeling empowered to have that conversation with their doctor. But also just to say, like, hey, I heard that I don't have to keep peeing on myself when I run or jump. And this is a thing that I want to try, because that's something that's become really normalized. Or like the expectation that sex is going to be painful, you should just like relax and drink wine and use lube and it'll get better. Like that doesn't happen for a lot of folks. So, advocating for yourself, like, you are allowed to want to do things that will improve your quality of life.
Totally. Yes. Thank you so much. This was so amazing and I really appreciate it. Do you want to share where people can find you or like your work or?
Yeah. So I have a Facebook page. It's called Marissa Carter, Pelvic Floor Physical Therapist. Mm. And then I have a pelvic health page on Instagram and it is called Pelvic Health with Marissa. I share just all kinds of stuff on those pages. This last month, I shared a lot of content about menstruation. So I got a pelvis model and we went through how to insert and remove a menstrual cup and the things that you can do to prepare for stuff like that. And I'm always open to creating content if people have requests for it too. So I just find that everybody has learned and heard and experienced different things. And so whatever we can do to share knowledge about stuff that people don't know or re-educate in things that are incorrect, like just expecting to pee on yourself forever.
That drink wine and pain will be better.
Like, in what other environment are we like, use substances to be able to like
just relax? It's like, I tried that. Thanks.
Yes. Well, and I hate that advice because like, if I could just relax, would we have any problems?
Yeah. Ever? It's like no, obviously a lot of that. Yeah.
This was Psych in the City. I'm your host, Sarah Kelleher. You can find me on Instagram. I am back at Psych and the City BK. You can find Marissa Carter and all of the resources that she listed in the show notes below. Thanks for listening.